This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Economists. I'm Peter Martin.
And I'm Gigi Foster. Hello.
Gigi, it's raining money. I described that in something I wrote as like a series of Russian dolls. We had 18 billion for people who fell through the cracks. Then we had 90 billion to help banks lend to businesses. We had 66 billion to double Newstart. Now 130 billion for paying half the workforce, really 1,500 a fortnight. It's beginning to look like serious money.
A billion here, a billion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money.
And where's it coming from? That's what we'll be talking about with Stephanie Kelton, an advisor to US presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders, because it's a question facing not only Australia, almost every country there is. First, though, who's been left out? Anyone?
Well, Peter, as we've spoken about in our recent episodes during the corona crisis, everyone is feeling the hit, both in Australia and all across the globe. And not just today, but also in the future. And not just in money terms, but in terms of human welfare, the thing that economists seek to maximize. And unfortunately, no government money infusion, no matter how well designed, can hope to fully compensate for these kinds of welfare losses because it's just too hard to work out where is all the pain and how much of the pain is there to have any hope of really compensating people for
it. So you're seeing an overhang, like a lasting damage.
Absolutely.
Not because of debt, which we're going to talk about, but because of the damage to people?
The damage to people today, the damage to people going into the future, as we've spoken about, and we'll speak about again, I'm sure, on future episodes. But I also will say, I expect for economics in the academy that this is going to be a bit of a boon. There's going to be an avalanche of economic research about the welfare effects.
Springtime for Hitler in Germany. Absolutely. Great for economists.
Well, but that's what, this is the kind of thing we love, because we can figure out what the connection is between government responses and human welfare.
And we have control groups.
Absolutely. You've got different countries doing different things. And I just saw the other day, there's a paper that's just come out by some economic researchers in South Africa and New Zealand who are tracking happiness as judged by the emotional tenor of tweets in response to activity restrictions that are being set progressively in different countries. And they're already documenting large declines in their measure of happiness as economies have been shut down around the world. But if you go back to just the question of money, right, then your question is who's left out? And one group left out of the government spend so far here in Australia and making the news a little bit is landlords.
Yeah, now what the government has done is said, if you're a renter, a residential renter, you can't be kicked out for 6 months, right? You've got security. For commercial renters in shopping centres and so on, their rent has to be reduced, at least for the time of this crisis, by the amount that their turnover is down. We spoke earlier to Stephen, who's one of the landlords on the receiving end of government policy. We started by asking him what type of properties he owns.
So we have two buildings in the eastern suburbs of Sydney. They're mixed use, so we have residential tenants as well as commercial tenants. It was just what I decided to put my money into so that I could build a nest egg, and obviously a significant amount of my rental return goes to the bank.
So, in fact, it's not only your savings that you've put in, it's also that you've borrowed to do this and you need to make mortgage payments.
Yeah, exactly.
And what is facing you now?
Look, we all know that everyone has to shoulder some of the burden here. You know, everyone isn't making money, then everyone has to contribute. I get that. We all get that. But I think the big challenge here is that when people hear things from the government, like there's a moratorium, you can't get kicked out for not paying your rent, and people start talking 6 months, there are tenants that think, well, I'll just stop paying my rent for 6 months. And so now I've got a situation where I could lose 6 months rental, 50% of the building's, you know, turnover this year. And I think everyone just assumes that as a property owner, that's all gravy, but it's not.
Has this happened to you?
So currently, about 50% of my tenants have missed their rental payments over the last 2 to 3 weeks. I have one commercial tenant that specifically came to me and I welcomed the opportunity to sit down with them and we agreed on a plan, and now I'm just waiting for them to honour that plan. So, you know, we're caught in the middle. So when the government then say, and we want banks to sit down with landlords, the banks, sure, are talking to us. And for the most part, they're saying, oh, well, that's all right. You can defer your payments. But ultimately, we've got to make the payments. And so we're having the same or trying to have the same conversations with our tenants. But unfortunately, some are not speaking to us and just choosing not to pay rent.
So are you finding that those renters who are not paying are the ones who are affected more by job loss or by reductions in their own business turnover if it's a commercial renter?
The ones that are just simply not paying are more the commercial tenants, not the residential. And from our point of view, we will help whoever needs the help most. I mean, of course, as I said, some of the rent that we earn is our income. And so, you know, I'm happy to talk about discounting the rent and deferring part of the rent, but I can't just not have people pay rent or we're going to default on our mortgage payments. So, you know, we've got a couple of residential tenants. One of them has absolutely lost 90% of their household income. They're doing their best. They've agreed to pay half rent for the next couple of months, but if they're not able to make an improvement, I would rather be in a position where I can let that tenant live rent-free and a tenant that has not lost their job pay full rent so that my net result is I'm at least still getting a 50% return on my residential part of the building. It's something that people don't understand, and it's such a grand sort of statement. Everyone interprets it differently. It's potentially going to be a big, fat mess if people don't sit down and talk.
Stephen, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
So, Peter, should we feel sorry for this landlord?
On an individual basis, yes. But you've got to bear in mind that the measures the government's doing are rough and ready. And generally, you know, I don't want to stereotype landlords, but the fact is they have money, whereas people who are working may have lost their jobs, may have lost hours, the people whom the $1,500 a week is designed to look after, they don't have money. So there's that argument for not giving too much attention to the concerns of landlords. Also, a lot of landlords, not Stephen perhaps, but a lot of them, 60% negatively gear. I've got no sympathy for them because they're trying to lose money on rent. That's the purpose of it. And we have traditionally, Gigi, back in biblical times, we've always treated capitalists, people making money from money as opposed to making money from labour. We've always been harder on people with capital than people without.
Okay.
That's my argument against yet another measure to support people like Stephen. The reality is that things have changed for him. They've changed for him because people have lost their jobs. Okay, one of his tenants walks, right? Can't walk, but he wants to be able to evict tenants, or probably more accurately, threaten to evict tenants credibly. Who's going to rent a house from him? At what rate? It's the same with these shopping centres. I mean, if Smiggle, if Meijer leaves, who's going to come back?
No, but that's exactly right, because the demand has gone down.
This is real.
Yeah, absolutely. The demand for renting properties anywhere by anybody has tanked. That's what you get in a recession. You get prices going down for leases and properties in general.
I'm arguing this is always a risk. Maybe certainly not a foreseen risk.
Well, yes, of course, it's always possible that there will be an economic downturn and people will lose some of their wealth. That's happened to most of us, Peter, right? I mean, your family wealth has probably tanked by 20 or 30%, just like mine.
I don't have family wealth.
Well, so you don't have any money on the books. Most Australians, I think, would have some sort of savings, and some of us will have some of it invested. And you know, of course, investing in the markets does come with a risk. But remember that landlords, like anybody, have made past decisions like taking out mortgages that rely on that rental income. And it's reasonable in a society like Australia's, where we have contractual law, to assume that rental income is pretty secure. The government is not riding in on its white horse here and gallantly paying off people's leases. It's just saying, well, for 6 months, you don't have to pay. But then at the end of that, as a renter, you're still going to be up for that money. I mean, one suggestion might be an approach that we talked about with Bruce Chapman a couple weeks ago on the show, which is an income contingent loan scheme, similar to the higher education contribution scheme, where you provide an upfront loan that has to be repaid only in the situation that 6 months from now or a year from now, the revenue coming in is back to a particular amount that's sufficient to enable that repayment without too much pain. So,
yeah, I guess my view is that supporting everyone perfectly is the enemy of the good. And when you are in a crisis, yes, people will get hurt at the edges, but perhaps I'm not sympathetic enough.
Well, it's just, you know, if the government...
Perhaps I'm not sympathetic enough to people who have money.
Having money is one thing and having risk, but, you know, the people who have money are also people. And, you know, if the government is supporting everybody in the short run, then why not support landlords? And actually, for that matter, why not better support everyone, including renters, in the longer run through opening the pocketbook now?
Which gets us on to the topic of our program, which is where is the money coming from? How does the government get its money? Can it get it forever? Now, your head might explode, but I'll tell you what's happening now. And I've had to research it, really. It's quite amazing. Where is the government getting this money from? It's $200 billion. If you added up the numbers I said earlier, they add up to about that. A very significant amount. Now, how will it get it? Net debt used to be $12 billion, right? Before, you know, back in January. It'll blow out to, I suppose, $212 billion. Here's how it gets it. It gets it by selling bonds, which is pieces of paper with promises to repay and interest rates and so on. Simple. What if there aren't enough investors to buy the bonds, which could happen because every country is issuing bonds? What happened at the end of March? The Reserve Bank promised to step in and buy them, not from the government. It's sort of got a legal fiction that it won't buy them from the government, but it buys them from investors who will buy them from the government. And it's promised to buy an unlimited amount, as many as are necessary to keep the interest rate on bonds about where it is now. Yes, the Reserve Bank is owned by the government. So the government is buying the government's debt. Where does the Reserve Bank get the money from?
It prints
it. It literally prints it. And if you don't believe me, read an explainer that we'll link to from the Reserve Bank on the Reserve Bank's website. Now, it prefers to say it expands the balance sheet. Here's what it does. It says, we want to buy so many government bonds, so many billion dollars of government bonds. We put that on one side of the balance sheet. And on the other, we put the money we spent. And so the money we've spent equals the asset we bought. We're balanced. It's a balance sheet, right? So yep. It is printing money. And on the face of it, but the Reserve Bank hasn't done this, it hasn't done it for about half a century. It certainly didn't do it in the global financial crisis. Things weren't that bad. On the face of it, there's nothing to stop one part of the government financing the other by printing money. There would seem to be nothing to stop it forever.
Well, as we discussed on our own program back a year ago, the episode was entitled Debt, Deficits, and Good Housekeeping, What's All the Fuss About? National governments, unlike households, are in the unique position of being able to just print money, that is their national sovereign currency, to cover their expenses or put money into the economy with the stroke of a pen or the press of a machine in the national mint.
Gigi, if this is true, and it is true, why hasn't this been widely talked about, do you think? It's all in terms of spending and tax.
I think that's an easier model to understand because everybody in the lay economy runs a household and there is a definite need to balance the budgets in a household. You have to have your income that is covering your expenses. If your expenses run up, then you have problems. That's just not the same model that is applied to the government.
Why are governments different?
Because they issue a currency.
Oh, yeah, I don't.
Most of us don't.
I need to get
it
from somewhere else. And I need to get paid to do it. We're going to discuss this with Stephanie Kelton. She's the author of an incredibly well-timed book coming out in June entitled The Deficit Myth. This is The Economist on Radio National and via podcast with me, Peter Martin, and Gigi Foster. Can governments really keep spending for as long as it takes.
We are headed for $1 trillion debt. It is a bill that will saddle a generation.
That's Anthony Albanese talking about the debt that will be borne by our children in Parliament yesterday. Stephanie Kelton is a professor of economics and public policy at Stony Brook University in the US. She's a former chief economist on the US Senate Budget Committee and an advisor to presidential hopeful Bernie Sanders. She's also one of 50 people most influencing the policy debate in America, according to Politico magazine. She also had the pleasure of being here earlier in the year, in much better times, in January. Professor Kelton, thanks so much for joining us from New York.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
Thanks very much for being on the show.
We've looked at what the Reserve Bank is doing in Australia, creating money, literally to support the government programs to keep the economy afloat. The question that flows from that is, can government spend forever? As described, it looks as if that's what they're doing, but it's certainly not how it looked back in January when you visited. Are there limits?
Well, there are limits, but the government can, of course, spend what it authorizes itself to spend. So what you have in Australia is what we have in the US and what the British have and what the Canadians have, which is something we might call monetary sovereignty. We have governments that control, if you like, or issue their own sovereign currencies. We're not on a gold standard. We don't have fixed exchange rates. And as a result of the nature of the monetary system that the government is operating within, that gives the government the ability to run its finances in a way that it could not have done if it were on a gold standard, if it were tying its currency with a fixed exchange rate system, if it had to budget like a household. So the government has a great deal of flexibility when it comes to deciding how much it wants to spend. But the answer to your question, are there limits? The answer is yes. And those limits are in the real economy. They're not financial limits. They're the real resource constraints in any economy.
So I remember this because people in my generation and older remember from the 1980s what was happening in South America, when what we were told, at least, was all these South American countries were printing money to try to get out of debt. And as a consequence, this runaway inflation, people were taking wheelbarrows of currency into to pay for a stick of butter. I mean, that is, I think, one of the things people worry about when they consider the idea of just paying its way out of a recession or, you know, just flooding the economy with money. How do you prevent that from happening?
Well, okay. So when I say that the economy has its own internal constraint, let's think about a speed limit, if you like. Any economy can only handle so much spending at any point in time. And remember that spending doesn't just come from government. Spending comes from the household sector because we go out and buy consumer goods. It comes from the business sector. Businesses invest in capital equipment, machinery, build factories, and so forth. And it comes from the rest of the world. So to the extent that the rest of the world wants to buy things that are produced in Australia, that also adds some strain on your capacity, right? So in addition to what the government might want to spend. So if you add all of the potential spending together, the question is, does your economy have the capacity to handle all of that spending without mounting inflationary pressures? In other words, if somebody wants to spend more on something, can your businesses increase supply to handle that increased demand? So if you think about what happened in countries like Latin America, what you typically had were countries that were running very different kinds of monetary systems. They were tying their currencies to another country's currency. They had fixed exchange rate systems. They have borrowed in foreign currency, very oftentimes in US dollars. And so you can easily get into a situation in certain countries where the monetary system is different, where countries start borrowing in foreign currency, where you get a full-blown debacle as a result. But that's not what we're talking about here. That's not the situation in Australia. That's not the situation in the U.S. What we have happening today is a collapse of spending, which creates lots of room in the economy for government to step in and backfill some of that lost demand.
And Ed, you don't even refer to it as a stimulus. What's the term you use?
Well, I mean, I'm saying that right now we don't need stimulus. What we need is stimulus. We've asked a huge segment of the U.S. labor force, and not just here in the U.S., but around the world, we're asking people to socially distance. We're asking people to stay home. We're asking you to stay in place. So what I'm suggesting is that we really need to support that effort to stay in place. We need stimulus. We need to maintain people to the extent that we can be successful at this, keep people in their jobs, keep them employed, and keep the income coming in. Because what we're really doing is redefining people's job descriptions. Your job is not to go out and produce haircuts. Your job is not to go out and serve meals in a restaurant. Your job, it's not what you used to do. Your new job is to help us flatten the curve, to help us save lives, to help us get through this moment. And so that is your new job description. And we want to compensate people while they do that, because people need to do two things right now. They need to eat and they need to pay the bills. And there's not a whole lot of additional spending on consumer goods happening right now. So that's why I say we don't need stimulus. We're not encouraging people to go out and buy and support the economy so that we can recover jobs. We're kind of holding things in place right now, but we do need to maintain incomes so that people don't start missing a mortgage payment, a rent payment, a car payment, a student loan payment, an electric bill, a cable bill, a phone bill. And then you get this cascading wave of defaults going through the system that then carries the risk of a real full-blown banking crisis.
So it sounds like you're basically saying that the government's role, monetarily speaking, should be to calibrate the amount of money in the economy to the degree or the level of transactions that kind of need to occur because of what people require, the demands that the consumers will have and the supply that is out there, rather than thinking about the deficit per se as even a meaningful concept, right? And if we're a household, we think about a deficit as a meaningful concept. You know, if your expenses exceed your income, then you have a problem. Is the deficit actually even something worth talking about in the context of a government with its issuing its own sovereign currency?
Well, yeah, in the sense that the government's deficit becomes a financial surplus in some other part of the economy. So while the government is increasing its budget deficit, that is producing the financial assets, the dollars, if you like, that the rest of us desperately need right now. So the government's red ink becomes black ink in some other part of the economy. So if the government is spending 100 into the economy, but it's only taxing, let's say, 80 back out, we label that a government deficit. We say the government's ledger shows a minus 20. But what we forget is that if they put 100 in and only subtract 80 back out, they're making a deposit of $20 somewhere in the economy. That $20 is going. And so right now, the government's deficits are producing the income that is being lost by the generation of private sector payroll. And so it's critically important that these government deficits exist and that they're substantial enough to allow us to weather this temporary storm.
This is The Economist on Radio National with Peter Martin and me, Gigi Foster, and Stephanie Kelton from Stony Brook University in the U.S., author of The Deficit Myth, out in June.
Can government debts and government deficits go on forever? I ask that because if you look at Australia and if you look at the U.S., there's a graph in the presentation you gave earlier this year when you were in Australia, in Adelaide. You see that in almost every year, it's been a deficit. And it does raise the question, does government debt need to be repaid? That is the amount of government debt. Obviously, government debts are being repaid all the time. Can governments run deficits in almost every year?
Well, some governments can. It really is about how much leftover room there is in the economy after the private sector and the rest of the world make their decisions about how much they want to spend relative to how much they want to save. Remember that every dollar that I decide, let's say, to save instead of spend is a dollar that isn't captured by some business that's trying to earn revenue and turn a profit. So the more I save, the more room there is in the economy for someone else to come in and spend a dollar. The more I use my money to buy goods and services produced abroad, buy things from foreigners, the more room there is left in the domestic economy for higher spending. The more the government taxes away from me, the fewer dollars I have to turn around and spend into the domestic economy. So we call these demand leakages. They're savings, taxes, and the purchasing of imports are all demand leakages. And the bigger those demand leakages get, the more room there is available for what we could call injections of new spending from other sources. So it depends on the country. It depends on the size of the demand leakages. And that will be different for different countries, and it will change over time. So the size of the deficit that is appropriate in 1 year compared to the next year or 10 years from now is highly dependent upon the size of the demand leakages going forward. So if you're a country that's going to have large persistent demand leakages, let's say big trade deficits, there's going to be room for government deficits just about all the time. And then you asked about the government debt. So the thing that's important that I think a lot of people miss is what we call, unfortunately, the national debt is nothing more than a historical record of all of the dollars into the economy and not taxed back out that are currently being saved in the form of treasuries. That's what the national debt is. And it's really unfortunate
when you say treasuries,
given it this name.
When you say treasuries, you mean what we call government bonds.
That's right. So that's what the national debt is. And it is unfortunate that we've given it this name and we've attached the word debt to it, because people get uncomfortable about that. And then you start hearing people ask things like you did, which is, aren't we eventually going to have to pay it back? And people start talking about your share of the national debt as if it's something that you're personally responsible for and that it's going to mean higher taxes in the future, that we refer to it as the burden of the debt. It isn't that at all.
Stephanie Kelton from Stony Brook University in New York, author of The Deficit Myth, coming out in June. Thanks so much for joining us and enlightening us.
Thank you both for having me.
Thanks very much, Stephanie. And that's The Economists for this week. We'll put links relating to today's show on our website. That's The Economists at ABC Radio National. That's also where you can send us comments or questions or ideas for topics in the news you'd like discussed. Just click on Contact Us.
That's also where you can listen to the program and all of the others again, as well as via The Economists on the ABC Listen app or your podcast app of choice. Next week, we'll try to make sense of where we are in these uncharted economic waters, and we'll start thinking about what things will be like on the other side. It's certainly a good time to be talking about economics. See you then.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.